Welcome to The Art of the Impossible, a podcast for the design and manufacturing industry that explores how you can leverage technology, processes, and people to make the impossible possible. I'm Asif Mogul, Senior Industry Manager at Autodesk, and each week I'll be joined by two experts from the design and manufacturing world to discuss their perspectives on the challenges our industry faces and share what they're doing to overcome them. From smart products, mass customization, digitization, supply chain resilience, and the convergence of once diverse industries, this podcast is for anyone that runs a design and manufacturing business who's interested in making things possible. You can subscribe by following us on Apple, Spotify, or via your favorite platform. So hi, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. We've got a great subject to talk about today. And when you switch on the news, it's practically impossible not to hear a story or hear a news article that talks about the impact that we as a species are having on the planet in some shape or form. And they tend to be in two groups. They tend to be proactive, really positive, cool things that we are proactively doing, like the recent COP26 conference and the incredible Earthshot Awards that was launched recently and is going to be repeated. And sadly, there's some negative stuff that we are reminded of, like food shortages, like natural disasters that are increasing in the world, and also the increasing damage that we are having as a species to our oceans. And it might sound a little sad and depressing, but there is some good news, because behind all of these things, that the manufacturing industry is actually innovating hard to do some incredible things, like reduce and even potentially reverse the impacts that we as a species are having on the planet. And that's really the subject of today, how we can champion sustainability one innovation at a time. So to help me have this conversation, I've got two brilliant guests. We've got Alec Anderson, who's the co-founder of Coolmill. Now, Coolmill are innovating to help combat the looming food crisis. And Dr. Taryn Foster, who's the founder of Coral Maker. And they're harnessing manufacturing to restore coral reefs. So welcome to you both.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity to speak today.
No problem. So, Alec, let's maybe just go to you first. Could you tell us a little bit about Coolmill and the innovative way you're kind of addressing this subject of a global food shortage?
Yeah, we work in an antiquated and wasteful global industry that feeds half the world every day. And it's very, there's a massive amount of rice growing, about 750 million tons a year. And there's enough rice to feed around about 600 million people, won't make it from farm to fork because of poor post-harvest storage, drying, and where we sit is processing. So we started working on a new non-destructive, very simple, very gentle means of processing rice. And that means we can deliver more food from existing harvests with less power, less loss, and less damage. And that's important because, as we know, the population is set to grow to probably around 10 billion. And most of those additional newcomers to Earth will be eaters of rice. And rice will have to increase production by about 70% by 2050 to meet demand. So it's really important we make better use of what we already grow.
Fantastic. Thank you, Alec. And Taryn, when I read your sort of profile, what you're doing actually does sound like science fiction. And I'm obviously a huge fan of science fiction. Can you tell us a bit about the company and how you're innovating around the area of restoring reefs?
So I guess just my background is in coral biology. So I had studied the impacts of climate change on coral reefs. And it was during that time that I was researching coral reefs that we had these two global mass coral bleaching events unfold on the reefs that I was working on. And this was sort of quite impactful for me as a young scientist. And just to sort of give you an idea of what happens when there's a bleaching event, you know, a healthy reef should be a thriving, colorful, bustling, noisy place. And we sort of came back to these places we'd been studying a few months after a bleaching event, and it was just completely silent. All we could hear was ourselves breathing in our scuba gear. It was just brown slime covered the whole seascape. And that was sort of the start of this journey with Coral Maker. So this issue, the main issue that corals are facing is climate change. Our oceans are heating up because of climate change, and because of that we're seeing coral bleaching and mass mortality. So we obviously need to deal with climate change to solve this issue at the source, But even if we do cap climate change at 1.5 degrees, which is what we're all aiming for, we're still set to lose 70% or more of our corals. We've already lost 50% of them. And so that's where I see coral reef restoration fitting in, but it has to be large-scale coral reef restoration. So right now, we just are not producing and deploying enough coral for it to have an impact at the reef scale. We're actually several orders of magnitude off where we need to be to achieve reef scale restoration. And so that's where CoralMaker fits in. We're inspired by the manufacturing industry because the manufacturing industry already operates at this scale. So we're looking at things, and particularly we're drawing inspiration from the masonry manufacturing industry, so mass production in masonry manufacturing. But we're also using things like automation, AI-driven robotics. We want to create a supply chain to be able to upscale both the production and the deployment of coral reefs.
That sounds absolutely fantastic. So let's dive into lifting the lid on this. So Taryn, I'll stay with you. So the idea of using technology to solve global problems like climate change isn't new. And I get the sense that, once upon a time, it was only the very large organizations, the brand logo companies that would sort of talk about it or try and do anything about it. But it definitely feels like that's changed. We're seeing more and more companies that, potentially people have never heard of before, giving it a go and getting involved. Why do you think that is? What's really driven that sort of mass scale focus of the industry to solve a problem like climate change?
Well, first I should say that reef restoration isn't necessarily solving climate change, but it is working in conjunction with those climate solutions to sort of tackle this problem from two different ends, sort of thing, another tool in the toolbox, so to speak. And the idea there is, so we need action on climate change for coral reefs to be healthy and thriving again. That's an absolute must. But because the problem is so big and because we've already lost so much, we see restoration as an addition to action on climate change. And so, that's sort of the first thing to say with action on climate change and coral reef restoration in addition to that, and especially if we can do it at a large scale. If we can do reef scale restoration, then things like moving reefs to new locations or installing reefs in locations where they're better placed to withstand climate change, those types of things become possible when you can do large-scale production and deployment of corals. But back to your question about people giving it a go, certainly in my industry, in coral science, there's just been an explosion of people innovating in this space, and that really was driven by the 2016 global coral bleaching event. So there have been three global coral bleaching events. One was in 1998, and people sort of thought, oh, well, maybe that was a one-off thing. Hopefully that was a one-off thing. Then in 2010, when I was doing my PhD, we had another one, and people started getting more nervous. In 2016, we had the most severe and also the longest coral bleaching event on record. It touched reefs all around the world. And anyone who was working in that space in coral reef science was moved by this event. You can't not be. And so we had a lot of people that were working more in probably pure science that switched their attention to solutions-based science and started looking at collaborating with people who work in the tech world out of, I guess, desperation to do something to solve this problem.
Yeah, I mean, what a tragic set of circumstances to focus people's attention on these kind of issues that we're facing. So, Alec, do you think there's enough people, like yourself and Taryn, who are aware of the potential that technology can have when not say solving the problems, let's say addressing some of the challenges of climate change, as Taryn mentioned? Do you think enough people are aware of the potential impacts tech can have on this issue?
I think yes. Obviously, I don't know where you've been if you're not aware of some of the issues that we're all facing. Obviously, COP26 just being in Glasgow, I suppose there's a lot of words. There's not always necessarily a lot of action to follow those words, and I think that's the key driver going forward, is really converting that good intent. What is it you used to say? What's the old parable about the road to ruins?
Yeah, the road to success is paved with good intentions. I think that's the...
Yeah, something like that. But so, yeah, so, I mean, everybody's speaking the speak, but, you know, who's walking the walk is really the test of how we're going to get out of this. And like Taran, we're not the solution to the problem. We are a contribution to that solution. And I suppose in some of the respects, what we do is restorative as well, because we're growing a lot of rice that never makes it through to food, but we've taken the environmental impact of growing that rice with no benefit. Now, we still have the impact of growing the rice, but at least we can turn that into useful food at the end, so mitigating the impact. And we also are very low power, so we reduce the power consumption dramatically in actually processing the rice. So we are sort of contributing in both ends. So I think there's a, in our experience, it's not necessarily the lack of people wanting or having the solutions to make an impact. I think the missing link is really the connectivity to the funding to take these new ideas, these disruptive ideas, and get them out into the marketplace. And that's a key piece that's missing in the jigsaw right now, certainly for us.
So it's not really about technology. It's not really about awareness. It's about sort of enablement. If somebody has a disruptive concept, what I'm hearing you both tell me is that the challenge can be bringing together the right people, but also getting the funding to kind of turn a concept into something that's like a proof of concept, and then to your point earlier, Taran, scaling. So that's kind of some of the challenges, and it brings us into some of the other challenges that I'd like to talk about. So, Alec, you mentioned funding, but what were some of the other challenges you faced in developing your specific innovation? And Taran, I'm going to sort of ask you the same question in a moment.
So rice milling's been around for about 8,000 years, and we are the third generation. So there's a challenge right there. So mechanized rice milling arrived about 160 years ago and pretty much hasn't changed since. So we are in an industry that's conservative with a capital C. You know, I love this modern concept of fail fast and move on. I don't have an issue with that, just define fast. And rice milling 100 years is fast, you know. So there's the challenge. I think there's another fundamental barrier as well. If I'm buying a new iPhone and it doesn't work, it's not going to ruin my life. But if I buy 10 of our machines to put into commercial rice milling and it don't work, it's going to ruin my business. So the risk for an early adopter of a commercial disruptive technology, which by definition is going to be probably from a new unproven company, they're probably going to be under-resourced. The technology is going to be, in commercial terms, unproven. And so that's a huge challenge for both the funders and the potential early adopters. And I think that's perhaps something that's missing that governments can help with in terms of bridging that gap, encouraging, giving some sort of incentive to those early adopters in commercial terms to take the technology to compensate or to mitigate the risk that's undoubtedly involved in a new technology, because until you get out there and build the hours, you don't know what's going to be coming, you know. So that's kind of the challenge. I think the technology side's not such a challenge. And a lot of the technologies we deploy are not necessarily new technologies, they're just deployed newly to the rice industry. And so that's kind of the main challenges we would face, I think. So it's that cultural shift rather than a technology shift that's the problem.
Yeah, I mean, I just wonder sometimes if people's view of innovation is it's got to be big, shiny, disruptive. And what we're hearing from you is that actually the application and configuration of existing tech for a new problem could be as disruptive as you know, the next, you know, game-changing device that companies might launch. So
I think we live in a social media-driven world. And one of our problems is we don't have an autonomous vehicle and we don't have a drone. We don't have an app. So, you know, we sand rice for a living. How sexy is that, you know? But, you know, one day you'll be going in your autonomous car to Sainsbury's watching Netflix to find out there's no food when you get there, you know. And that's the problem. But, you know, politically, autonomous vehicles are in, you know. Who needs a spaceship? Right. We're not going to Mars to live, are we? Better we grow more rice here to feed ourselves.
Yeah, interesting. Okay.
So there's the problem for us.
Taran, I mean, presumably you must have faced kind of similar issues as you were bringing your innovation kind of online. Could you talk about what some of them are and what steps you're trying to take to overcome them?
So initially, one of the main problems was getting people together with the right combination of skill sets to be able to develop this. we're sort of using a bit of coral biology, which is what I bring to the table, a bit of design, engineering, robotics, AI, manufacturing. And so we had to get this team together, and also a lot of in-kind support went into this to sort of develop this idea. But the initial challenges was getting everybody speaking the same language, meeting them first, because we don't necessarily interact with people outside of our industries very easily. I don't think it's because people don't want to collaborate. I think people would love to, but you just don't have the opportunity to meet people in those completely different industries. You don't have the connections there. There's not the platform. And so it's been pretty special to even meet the incredible group that I've been working with over the last 2 years. And then, yeah, the first little while was just talking back and forth, making sure we're all on the same page, and discovering what each other's skill sets were and what that actually meant, like how they could be applied. And that does take a little bit of time when you've got people. I mean, we're all engineers and scientists, so in some way we do speak the same language, but it did take a little bit of time for us to all understand the problem, I guess, that we were solving. And then one of the more practical issues or problems that we've had to solve has been on the manufacturing side. So I had initially, so one part of what we're doing is that we're pre-making, so this is where the masonry manufacturing comes in, is that we're pre-making coral skeletons so that the corals don't have to do all of that calcification growth to get to size. And then we seed those skeletons with living fragments of coral. But to make the skeletons, my initial thought had been, oh, well, why don't we, you know, stone 3D print these, because corals have such gorgeous, complex morphologies. I was thinking of this 3D printer printing in stone. And it took a while, but eventually I sort of realized, well, we're trying to solve a scale issue here. The problem is scale. We can't be individually 3D printing. I mean, 3D printing technology is just not there yet for this sort of thing. It would take hours just to print one individual. So we've now settled on a more traditional manufacturing technique, which, you know, we can pump out like 10,000 of these skeletons in a day, but they're much simpler shapes. So we had to make compromises on the shapes we wanted to make just so that we could get to the scale that we want to achieve.
What you're both really talking about is you know, from the initial innovation to drive scale, the level of collaboration. I'm hearing you talk about, you know, having to bring and converge lots of people of different skill sets together, scientific skill sets, manufacturing engineering skill sets, and Alec, you talked about sort of, you know, financial skill sets, and also pulling all that together to start to at least get people clear on what the issue is you're trying to solve. It certainly sounds like it's a big challenge. And I suppose it totally makes sense when you're doing something so new and so innovative that people haven't thought of before. There must be no almost mental model for somebody to say, ah, that's what people are trying to do. So it feels like there's quite a lot of lag factor in that initial stage just to get people, as you said, Taryn, on the same page. When you do get people on the same page, and when you do, you know, sort of, you know, crank up the business and the, you know, your innovative ideas start to get out there. I wanted just to address the sort of comment I hear from a few people is that sustainability as a business model isn't as profitable or isn't as linked to growth as maybe the, you know, traditional kind of business model. So, Alec, you know, you're driving an innovation that's got a direct link to the impacts that we're having on the planet. Without going into too much detail, what have some of the impacts to the business been? Has it been, you know, embraced, adopted? Is it a successful innovation that you're now pushing out there?
Yeah, I think there's two parts to that question. One is the impact for us, and the other part is the impact for our milling partners. So we're not only having a new technology, as if that wasn't difficult enough to introduce, we're also introducing a new business model, which is, you'll be familiar, software as a service, and we're pioneering machinery as a service, and that makes we're about creating value. So right now rice milling is about cost reduction, ever bigger mills to reduce cost, to squeeze an ever reducing margin out of their existing technologies. We're trying to change that focus onto creation of value and then sharing that value between the partners. We don't have customers and suppliers, we have partners. We see long-term partnerships with those end users. And that's a mutually beneficial partnership where we can be almost like in an open book situation where we understand their business, they understand our business. And the point is the creation of value where 1 + 1 equals more than 2. and then distributing that that increased value more equitably between the stakeholders. And that's so, you know, if we were to put our machine, let's say we are competing against very low cost machines, if we were to try and compete on price with them, you know, the margins and returns for us are very poor. If we move to the servitization model, it takes away the technology risk, which is what I was alluding to earlier for a new technology. It's unproven, that stays with us. And we take away the high capital cost because they pay as they mill effectively, and then we share the benefits of that improved milling. And I think that's, again, significant in terms of opening the market up, both for us and for our end users, because there's about 1.5 million small or medium processors globally. They're excluded right now from access to modern high-performance rice mills because they don't have the capacity of rice, they don't have access to the finance, and they don't have the infrastructure to keep these mills running. But they don't have the money to buy our machines, which are perceived to be quite expensive. So how can we make that technology available to them so they can access it, make it accessible and affordable is the key. And, you know, we've been working with Aston University and the advanced services team there to develop business models that work both for them and for us. And, yeah, it was a challenge convincing them that that's a good way to go. But with the help of Aston, we've got very good responses now. And certainly Africa, it's a way forward for us in Africa and certainly in Asia and definitely in India.
And so what I'm hearing you say, Alec, is this is actually becoming a very viable business model. I hate to bring the word business into it, but I just wanted to address the issue that focusing on these types of, you know, challenges can be as value generating as the, you know, traditional industry. So what you're saying is that this is turning into a viable business model. Is that correct?
Yeah, our business plan right now is to grow a £100 million business in the next 5 years. Okay, so and if I gave you some of the numbers, it would blow your socks off with the impact we can have. So we're talking about our machinery can have a payback in days, if not weeks, if we were selling it. So that's why we want to go to this co-creation and co-sharing of value. So yeah, we are a truly disruptive technology that will redefine rice milling going forward.
That's so great to hear that this isn't just a concept that's struggling, but you know, people are buying into it, and you know, you're generating a business model, which in turn hopefully generates employment, creates value. So that's fantastic to hear. So, Taryn, from the conversations you've had, because you mentioned earlier on that you were in this kind of really, it sounds like an ultra cool world of science, engineering, and all these are different sort of disciplines converging. What do you think the attitudes towards businesses built around, you know, sustainable concepts is? Do they see them as a kind of nice to have science projects, or do people actually see them as this could be a viable business in itself?
I think attitudes towards that are changing. I think initially it would have been, yeah, like you said, you know, a nice to have. But I think now, especially with people wanting to, you know, meet their environmental and social targets as well as make a profit, I mean, you hear that triple bottom line all the time, like people are interested in this now, and it's not just businesses like mine and Alex that, you know, are targeting these specific problems. There are businesses that, you know, initially were just out there for profit, and now they really are looking into their environmental impact. And it might be in their supply chain, so they might be tackling things like their own carbon footprint or their own waste within their business and their supply chain. But there's also scope now for those larger corporations to start investing in other companies that might be able to tackle some of the sustainable development goals that have been put out in the last few years. And so I do think the attitudes towards that are changing. I think now there's as much value, or maybe not quite as much just yet, but there's certainly a lot of interest and a lot of value in social and environmental capital, as well as making a profit.
Yeah, I mean, I've read some stats that certain venture capital funds, they're sort of the ones that are based around sort of sustainability and greener, are performing almost, I think to your point, almost as well as the, let's just call them the others. And that seems to be growing and growing and growing over the years. So I hope we can get to a tipping point where people just say by default, yeah, this is going to be as, in fact, more value generating, more profitable for us and more sustainable in every sense of the word to have a business model that's based on sustainability. So
these companies are not just getting sort of public pressure. They also, their investors, their employees even want to see change in this space. So I think it's coming from internally within these organizations as well. And I know for sure that some of the people that I've worked with from larger companies have just been so excited to be working on an impact project. And so I think that's a way to sort of get employees engaged as well within their companies to work on projects that they can see are making a difference.
That's a great point. The people that you employ. So Alec, what noticeable impacts or effects have you seen on the people that you employ in terms of like the culture of Cool Mill? How has that changed a lot? Has it always been, you know, we're very focused on solving this kind of issue, or have people's attitudes towards climate change changed the further into this project you've gone?
Yeah, it's interesting that we call it profit with purpose. So I think, I mean, we contribute to 16 of the 17 sustainable development goals. And I think when you start talking, particularly to funders about things like that, they think, oh my goodness, here comes another tree hugger trying to save the world. And no, we are very much a for-profit company, but why not make a profit out of doing something that has positive social, environmental, and economic impact? That's the key. And that's the sweet spot. And we've got a very energized young team, which I'm having to up my game to keep up with. I suppose sad reflection on the times is that when COVID struck, Innovate UK were very proactive in supporting companies like us who had active projects. And we were able to extend some of the projects and pick up some very talented young engineers that would not normally have been available to a company like us. And through that interaction, I mean, these are all people who are motivated. They've all got the vision. Our vision is to transform an antiquated, wasteful global industry, move it to a sustainable future, and lift millions from food and fuel poverty. There's nothing about money in that. If we do a good job or even get some way to achieving that goal, we will create a very profitable business. But I guess as a family business, we are not shareholder-driven. We are values and vision-driven. And the people who work in our company all are bought into that value, those values and that vision. And I think what Taryn's saying is right. I mean, in an ever-competitive world, particularly with the younger generation who don't seem to see a job for life as the way forward, attraction and retention of talent is really key. And so having that these core values and living, not just having them on a piece of paper, but living to those values is becoming increasingly important. And I think as Taryn touched on, that's going right through the whole chain, right through to your investors and also to your consumers. So how are you being perceived externally? And in the world of social media, it's very easy, you know, bad news travels fast. So you need to have that sort of brand DNA, and you need to have that embedded in your company and everybody embedded in that DNA, because you'll get found out if it's not there. You know, greenwashing's not going to last for long.
You mentioned a really interesting point there about skill set. And I don't think we've had a podcast episode where culture and skill set isn't brought up, but I'd be interested in both of your points of view on this. So one of the things that we hear a lot about the, you know, people who are graduating from engineering or design, you know, colleges and universities around the world is they have high levels of digital awareness. They might lack kind of industry experience. What I'm wondering is, from your experience, Taryn, maybe we could start with you, how kind of climate change aware are they? I think beyond just kind of realizing it's a very, very serious issue, what sort of level of knowledge and experience do they get exposed to around the impacts of design and manufacturing on climate change once they graduate? Is it high? Is it non-existent? What's your experience?
That's an interesting question. The people that I've been working with have had a really high awareness of the impact of what they do. And, you know, with things like product design, for example, and building something so that it can be recycled, or you know, thinking about the materials that go into product design and what the lifespan of those materials are and where they're actually going to end up. I think that's a really important skill set for engineers and designers to have, to think about, you know, not just is this going to solve a problem, is this tool going to work, but what materials are going to go into designing this and where are they going to end up? So in the marine world, I mean, they've said, I'm sure you've heard, that there's now more microplastic or more plastic in the ocean than fish. You know, like, we really need to start thinking about this. It takes plastic like 1,000 years to break down. And there are so many cases where you can use alternative packaging, even single-use plastic is, and I think that's where companies can can make a difference in their own right, just make little changes like that to, you know, how, you know, just how they're packaging things, how, what materials they're making things out of. But I think that really does start in the design phase. It needs to be thought about in the design phase. So the people I've worked with have been amazing on that front. I'm not sure about new grads, but that would be something I would hope that they're getting taught at engineering school.
Alec, what's your experience in terms of, I think you've told me before that you do take, you sort of, you do a lot of work in STEM. I know that you're a sort of STEM ambassador. From your experience of working with new graduates coming out of design or engineering, you know, at universities, how, let's call it, environmentally aware are they, as well as their engineering and design skill sets?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a generational shift between my generation, which was focused on cost reduction, and this generation, which is slightly more visionary, I suppose. They have great ambition, but sometimes the details, how we're going to deliver, and, you know, we're talking about, and it's difficult to generalise. We're talking about the generation that goes to Glastonbury and leaves the tents behind. They go on marches with the bottles of water that they buy for, you know. So there's a little bit of contradiction there between saving the world and I like my mobile phone and I like my disposable fashion, and, you know. So yeah, you've got to live the dream as well as spout the dream. So yeah, but they're very driven along this cause. And I think the blend of experience that we have and maybe the bitterness of age and the bitter experience of age, and we can redirect some of that enthusiasm into, you know, longer term. So for instance, right now we're really looking at design for service rather than design for manufacture. The cost of the product is not relevant over the long-term value that that product's going to deliver. So our machine's going to mill something like 150,000 tons of rice next year. You know, if it costs 10% more to make it more efficient, more recyclable, our machines are designed to be remanufactured and reused, not recycled. So by, as Taryn touched on, I think if you start at the beginning with the end point, which is the total life of the product rather than how cheap can I make it to compete with China, that's not relevant, I think, going forward. It's really that whole change. Again, it's a cultural shift in thinking. And maybe it's my generation I'll have to retire before that really preeminent, you know, or percolates throughout industry at the higher levels.
And there definitely is a shift away from value being defined as profit to value being defined in kind of, you know, more holistic terms. I mean, I've certainly, a lot of the guests that we've spoken to are starting to talk about this kind of lifetime of the product, and that the cost is pales into comparison if you compare it to the lifetime value it generates over the, you know, how long it's used. So that's pretty encouraging to see. So to get to that point, I wanted to talk about scaling, because you know, Taryn, you know, you mentioned it, and it's potentially one of your challenges, is how, I mean, from your specific point of view, what is the single or top two or three scaling challenges you need to overcome? And maybe, Taryn, we could start with you. You talked about sort of, you know, getting this, you know, produced at much greater volumes. You were saying that the current production volume is orders of magnitudes out. Just talk to us a bit about the challenges, you know, the specifics and what you need to do to overcome that.
So I think with coral reef restoration or installation of new reefs, the main problem is that we don't actually have a supply chain at this point. We're essentially starting this industry from scratch. And so that's good in terms of giving us scope to do it the right way and build our supply chains the right way and think about our carbon footprints and our materials and all of that sort of thing. But up until now, and even now, reef restoration projects are usually done by small groups, and they're very sort of local scale. They're often NGOs, you know, small scale with volunteers and things like that. And that is a problem when we want to scale up to millions or tens of millions. You really need a supply chain to do that. And so we're creating products that will allow that supply chain to develop, but there are going to have to be other groups that come to the party at different points in this supply chain. So we want to make the pre-made skeleton. We're developing robots to do some of the manual tasks in coral propagation. So both cutting and gluing corals, or seeding our little seed plugs of corals into these pre-made skeletons. We're working on certain sections of the supply chain, but there are also going to be sections that need to be scaled up massively to keep up with this. So coral farming, for example, we need to be able to grow enough broodstock sustainably to be able to do these large-scale projects. And then the other big bottleneck in the supply chain is going to be deployment. How do we deploy thousands, tens of thousands of corals per day? How do we deploy millions or tens of millions of corals per year? At the moment, it's being done by divers. It's being done by hand. But perhaps, you know, we'll start looking at things like remotely operated vehicles. I know there are groups already working on the deployment side of the problem. But I think, yeah, if I had to pick the single biggest challenge, it's that we haven't developed a supply chain yet. And so we're sort of, the products we're coming up with sort of break the steps down to make it possible to have different people focus on the different parts of the project. So we've got plugs that the corals will be grafted onto, so the people who are growing the coral can graft onto those plugs. Then we've got this separate part of the process where we're seeding into the skeleton, and then we've got a way to transport them so that they can be stacked efficiently, because we're transporting live coral here. So, you know, you've got seawater, it's got to be a good temperature for the corals, it's got to be oxygenated. There's all sorts of challenges with transporting coral. But one thing for sure you don't want to be doing is transporting a big branching staghorn coral in a big tub of water, because you've got this tiny biomass of actual living coral for this heavy amount of seawater that you have to transport around the place. And so if you've got a way to put them into smaller pieces and on little plugs and stack them into trays and efficiently pack them, then it allows us to develop a supply chain. So yeah, I think that's the number one thing we need to get right.
It never ceases to amaze me how important supply chain is just to get anything done in, you know, kind of in this industry. So that's a really great example there, Taryn. Thank you. Alec, from your perspective, we could say that the cool meal products are more sort of traditional engineering type of products. What are some of the scaling challenges that you face? You did mention funding earlier, but are there some other challenges to help you get to the scale you need?
Yeah, Taryn mentioned, we had we use 3D printing, and we can print things on the printer that we can manufacture at scale. And there's a long way to go before 3D printing becomes a viable volume manufacturing process. So the challenge for us is not so great in terms of the engineering. It's the consistency and quality. So it's really a quality process control. The actual basic engineering and making our machines is relatively simple. And we've manufactured in India, we manufactured in China, but we've had some quality issues there, and trying to get the consistency right is a problem. And what we've done now is bring manufacture back to the UK, where we can ensure that quality. And then over time, we'll then start to build up the local content in the machines, the non-critical parts, and then upskill. It comes back to skills again. You have to upskill the people. You have to get the right machinery in place. And from that, that's a co-investment by our manufacturing partners in country. But if you think about it, we are manufacturing in Birmingham. We've got hundreds of thousands of machines potentially in Asia. Are we going to make those hundreds of thousands of machines in Birmingham and ship them to Asia? Probably not. But right now it's really critical that the quality is maintained. And I think the big challenge when you scale is, how do you maintain the values and ethos that your company is built on? How do you maintain the consistency of the product quality and the experience of the end user? How do you adapt it to the different conditions? Because what works in India might not be right for China, and certainly won't be right for Africa. So these are all the challenges. And it's, I know we work together on the future of manufacturing. I don't ever see an individually customized cool mill machine for every single customer, but I can see, you know, specific variants for rice and for other industries as well, other products. So that's kind of the challenges for us. But the more common the parts are across that range of machines, obviously the better for scaling the manufacturing.
Thanks, Alec. We're getting into that, I suppose, the final chunk of the conversation, which is, I'd like to ask you both what's next on your business journeys, but then come to, if you had to give some advice to other execs or people who are running or have founded companies, based on an innovative idea that's linked to sustainability or climate change. I'd like to just get your view on what's a piece of advice you'd give them, so maybe they don't struggle with some of the challenges as much as you guys have. So what's next on your journey? Taryn, let's just come to you first. What's next for Coral Maker?
Well, the next thing on the horizon for us is a larger scale pilot study. So at the moment, we've got a little bit more R&D to do with our robotics, but basically we've got a bunch of things working now, and we've got a small scale pilot with our products in the ocean here at the Abrolhos Islands of Western Australia. But it is a small scale project. We're just sort of testing them on our pre-made skeletons. But in the future, what we'd like to do is a larger scale pilot where we want to sort of attempt to do, say a year's worth of the current restoration in a few weeks or in a month or something along those lines, and see if we can do it at a quicker pace with this automation involved and with this technique and with this supply chain. So that's sort of what we're gearing towards now, getting partners and getting funding for this larger scale pilot project.
Sounds exciting. And then if you had to give a piece of advice to, the question I always ask is, imagine every single CEO or managing director of a design and manufacturing company is listening. I wish they were. And they're waiting for you to give them a golden nugget of advice. What advice would you give to them in terms of how they might innovate around the topic of sustainability and climate change?
Oh, that is a good question. Well, I think let's focus on innovate first. I think innovation really happens when you get the right mix of people together. And I really do think that that happens the most when you go across industries. So I would advise people to reach out to the industries and to the people that they think have the skill sets that they might be able to use, even if it's in a completely different industry. And, you know, it is actually intimidating reaching out to people who have a different skill set to you because, like I said, you have to learn how to speak the language that they speak in their field, and you have to be okay with becoming a complete amateur at something you know nothing about. But I think that's where innovation happens, is you can get two completely commonplace ideas in their separate fields and you bring them together and all of a sudden you've got something completely innovative. And so I think that's something that I would recommend to anyone who's looking to develop an idea. From a sustainability perspective, there's two things. I guess one is to look at their own business and their own carbon footprint. And like I was saying before, you can do that just looking at your immediate product and the materials you use and the amount of energy it uses and that sort of thing, all the way to looking at your entire supply chain, like who's supplying you, where did that come from, and digging right into it. But another thing that I'm hoping will happen in the future is that there will be more support through bigger companies for companies like ours that are having a direct impact on the environment, because they are, you know, they do have the one thing that we need, which is funding, and a lot of them are seeking the capital that we have, which is social and environmental capital. So it seems like a no-brainer to me that the two should connect.
Yeah. So to that last point is really interesting. Why wouldn't a kind of a large, well-established organization, which has got, you know, a level of cash flow and kind of income, why wouldn't they choose to partner or even invest in some really innovative, disruptive concepts like, Coral Maker is producing? So that's a really interesting point. Alec, I'll come to you. So first of all, what's next on the journey for Cool Mill?
The next thing is to, we will be expanding our operations in India as soon as we can get back to India, which we hope to be imminently. And then we're also running some projects in Africa, which we hope to expand into full commercial operations in the near future. So that's kind of our focus at the moment. Yeah, it's interesting times. We've had some challenges over the last 2 years, but we've made a lot of good progress in that time. We've utilized that time to develop solutions which will stand us in good stead going forward.
And then pearls of wisdom from you to the global leadership.
If you're going to rattle the cage, you better believe in what you're doing, because trust me, the people in the cage won't like what you're doing. And to answer the question you posed earlier is, why won't these big corporations invest in companies like Taryn's and ours? It's because we threaten their very existence in some aspects. So if you look at Kodak or the British motorcycle industry and various things like that, I think it's like Kito is the Japanese business model. They have so much vested interest in what they are doing. Electrolux and Hoover and Dyson, probably a great example. So they'd much rather the new technologies didn't succeed because that's attacking their core businesses, which are cash cows for them. So don't underestimate the pushback you're going to get, and that'll test your belief. The other sort of really, if you want to save a lot of time, is don't try and do it on your own. Taryn's absolutely right. You can't know everything. Don't try and be Richard Branson. You are not Richard Branson. You can learn some of the things, or Bill Gates, or whoever you want to choose. But you can learn from what they've done and try and apply it. But don't try to mimic because it's not going to work. You have to be the best you can be. You have to believe in your technology, but you have to, develop these strong strategic partnerships who can help you move. They have knowledge and experience. I'm all with Taryn. We go to a lot of exhibitions, and I was talking to someone who's making fighter planes for the RAF, and we have the same problems, and he had a great solution. I'm brilliant. I'm going to steal that. So this cross-fertilization of ideas is really, really productive if you keep your mind open when you're in these situations. We've developed a partnership, 7 countries, 40, more than 40 partnerships now, from rural mills in Africa and Asia and India, right up to large multinationals, academic, industrial, commercial. Today I'm in Sheffield at the National Centre for Excellence in Food Engineering, where we've got a collaborative partnership with them, and we've created a global centre of excellence for cereal milling here. So we're bringing together industry and the academic rigour, especially if you've got a new disruptive technology, having that academic sort of backing to your, giving people confidence that you're not just some nutcase that's come up with this wacky idea, So that's it. It's really about that integration and that bringing together all those different skills. Recognize what you don't have and go out and find it, I guess, is the key there.
Yeah, there's again that sense of convergence of maybe go and talk to people you probably wouldn't normally, but
Absolutely.
it's just kind of borrowing ideas, borrowing best practices from one industry to another seems to be a great way to do it. So, okay, well, I've got the really difficult thing to do now in terms of trying to summarize everything that I've learned from you both. And I'm going to give it a go, and you can give me marks out of 10 if you like, as long as it's not, really low. So I think when we're talking about innovation in the context of sustainability, what I've heard from you both is that there actually are lots of opportunities to innovate in the field of climate change and sustainability. And more importantly, it's not a choice anymore. We have to do it. As a design and manufacturing industry, we absolutely have to do it and should be doing it. But to be successful at it, I think, to have a purpose, to pick something that you strongly believe in, as the both of you have demonstrated on this call today. And because without that drive, without that passion, maybe it just will become just another thing for funders and investors and your partners to look at. So have a purpose. That was a very, very clear thing that I got from you both. The second thing was the importance of collaboration, partnership, convergence. This seems to be critical because you can't do everything on your own. You can't know everything on your own. And why should you try and do it on your own? If there are people out there, you can bring them together, like-minded individuals or organizations, perhaps the chances of success will be increased. So I got the really strong sense from you both of being open to collaboration, being open to partnerships, being open to divergent thinking from multiple different industries. And then the last thing, or the last two things are, think about the supply chain impacts far earlier. Because if you have a great idea and it's proven, whether it's in an early stage pilot or a second stage pilot, the critical success factor is having a supply chain that might help you take this thing, this idea, this concept, and sort of scale it. Because scaling seems to be the biggest issue. And for anyone that's listening that thinks, well, actually, I don't have an innovative idea around climate change or sustainability, what Taryn, you said is you can start in your own backyard. Take a look at the environmental impact of your own products or your own supply chain or your own factory operation. So it feels like there's plenty of opportunity for manufacturing and design companies to really go at if they want to innovate in the area of sustainability. Let me just check in with you both. Do Do you feel that's a good summary of what we discussed? Did I get it right?
I think you did a great job.
Don't give me marks out of 10, please. I'll be really gutted. It's really low.
No, I think you nailed it.
Thank you. Alec, did I miss anything?
Yeah, I would just say maybe it can be very profitable as well.
Of course.
And so you shouldn't be doing it just for the environmental the environmental impact. It's about that impact, the profit with profit with purpose basically is the key. So that's got to be, ultimately you have to make profit to survive. But as I said before, why not make profit from doing something that has a positive impact?
Great catch there, Alex. Thank you. So as always, we've come to the end of today's episode. I've personally enjoyed it a lot. It is a subject I care a lot about personally. But I hope that you, as you've been listening to today's conversation, have heard something that grabs your attention, heard something that inspires you to want to try innovating, hopefully in the area of sustainability, or at the very least, try and reduce your own environmental impact on the business. And I think it's not really all about just being less bad. And I think a lot of the things that we hear around sustainability are, I'm generating so many tons of carbon, but I'm planting a few trees. No disrespect to any organization whose strategy incorporates that. But I think there's a tipping point. We could stop just being less bad and add to that being truly disruptive and innovative and proactive. And I think the combination of those two things will be the difference that makes a difference. So I hope you've heard something on today's episode that maybe inspires you to certainly be less bad, but also be more proactive. And all that's left is for me to thank my fabulous guests, Alec Anderson, the co-founder of Coolmill, and Dr. Taryn Foster, the founder of Coral Maker. Thank you both so very much. It's been great having you on this episode. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time on The Art of the Impossible.